everybody. Good morning. This is Little Wars. I'm one of your co-hosts, Mongoose Kikimora. And with me on this wonderful Saturday morning, or well, whenever you're listening to it, really, is your other co-host and my good friend, Jack. How you doing, Jack?
Hey, folks. Well, I don't know. The weather's pretty bad out today, but it'll clear up.
Yeah, I'm where I'm at. It's pretty well. I don't like talking about the weather because that's people can figure you out, man. So I'm smarter than that.
CIA. Yeah, by fucking airplanes and stars and shit, right?
Well, yeah, theoretically.
The sky, no.
Well, I mean theoretically, you know.
That's
I
a
always
he will not
make sure I use I always make sure I use the incognito mode. The FBI is not going to get me. You know, shitpost and incognito, you know, that kind of thing. So that's what's going on my end. Jack, what have you been up to game wise this week? What are your games been like?
Well, tomorrow I'm going to be playing a 3,000 point game with a buddy who's going, who's getting deployed. So I moved some stuff around and made a special time slot for him so that we can get a game in before he has to go away. But, yeah, other than that, well, I've just been painting my Death Watch. Like that's pretty much it. And I'm starting to eye all of the Warhammer Fantasy models that I acquired a couple of months ago that are not painted, and I've been looking into a few ways to play with them. But yeah, I've got mostly I guess it's undead. I don't know. I haven't really explored it too much, but it's mostly undead and vampire counts. So should be pretty fun.
Yeah, on my end, I haven't really been up to much other than role-playing games this week. I'm hoping to get a 100-point Flames of War game in this evening. I may take some pictures, post them online. I did end up shitposting about Maid a little bit sometime this week with some friends and online.
Tisk, tisk,
tisk. Maid is, again, great if you're drunk. I'm not gonna get off this train no matter what anybody says. Like, I'm just not going to. I just find it immensely entertaining for a lot of reasons. So there's that.
My local Lowe's, by the way, ran out of eye bleach.
Yeah. I did a little bit of eye bleaching, or I forced some people to use eye bleach. I personally am not a believer in eye bleach. I am a very eclectic and kind of, I'm kind of, you know, just a broken guy, a few screws loose over here, mostly, on my end. So Jack probably knows that more than anybody, or anybody who's read my Twitter, really. So there's all that. Anyway. So, Jack.
Yes.
This week, we've got some more what you doing there, wizards? Kind of things going on, you know.
Now, yeah, a few things.
Quite a few things. So they did the they're doing the bit. They're doing the bit really hard. They're doing their initiative, if you will, their diversity visa lottery, if you want to call it that, Heart Seller Immigration Act, but for trading cards, if you want to call it that. I'm not exactly sure what their end game is. Jack, do you have any idea what their end game here was with all this sort of stuff?
End game? You mean as far as the 5th edition Ravnica book?
Well, there's a 5th edition Ravnica book. There's the card art they've been releasing has been horrendous. Ravnica is most definitely not the ethnostate. Nor is it a methnostate. A methnostate would be more rad than Ravnica. It's basically turning into just a lame steampunk world, and there is nothing worse than lame steampunk, let me tell you.
Steampunk,
but with wizards instead of steam engines, which is even worse.
Well, it's magic punk, right?
Oh my lord, don't know.
Except it's not really like dystopian at all. I mean, to be a punk, like a steampunk, requires, you know, it's not just the technology or whatever. It's the setting.
Here's the thing I want to know is so as long as we can just put a technological era in front of a punk thing, can I just like make that into a genre? Can we do like Stone Age punk, Stone punk, like Grug cut hair, Grug put blueberry in hair, Grug go beat up tax Grug in tax cave, Grug punk Grug, you know, is that like a viable setting or a thing for me? Could we maybe make that into a multi-million-dollar franchise?
Long Nose Tribe claim they lost six in a Hollabunga.
yeah, that kind of deal. That would be you know, always remember the Hollabunga or whatever.
What is the article called? Something like Demir is getting like fresh diversity because diversity is our strength or something.
No. It was actually like changes coming to Ravnica and changes good for the Demir. And it's the card art is like this John Boyega looking dude behind this chick, like, bruh, you want to know some like esoteric secrets? You know what I'm saying? Kind of look on his face, and she's got this look like, no, I didn't ask for this eldritch knowledge, my man. You know how it goes. They've got this deal going on here. I mean, like, you know, it's obviously like they're not talking about like mud diversity in the thing. It just happens to be that you could easily make it that way, but it also happens to be that the card art is exceptionally ugly nowadays. Not saying the early stuff was like something to shake a stick at, because a lot of it looked pretty dumb. Like there was like a good middle ground there, like probably before the original Innistrad like was about like where it like stopped. Mirrodin was pretty nice looking, just because of how weird it was and alien. It always impressed me as a kid was Mirrodin, but honestly, the newer art is just nasty.
Yeah, it seems very computer generated. I don't know if that's true or not.
I would say it is at the very least computer aided, but I've seen better art drawn with the aid of a computer, but that's just because the women were more attractive. I mean, it's one thing. It's like if everything's going to be a black woman, could we at least make sure they're like attractive black women?
Like, well,
it would be less insulting to me. Like, it would be less insulting to me that way, because then it's at least like I got something nice to look at here, you know?
Yeah, I'm just. Well, okay, so we could have predicted this, right?
Well, I think very much so.
Who's the head designer for Magic the Gathering exactly?
What's his name? Oh, I don't know his name.
It's Mark Rosewater.
Well, yeah.
Didn't you know?
Yeah, I mean he is. Well, yeah, I mean that makes sense. But I mean we could have predicted this even earlier, and you just like. Well, duh, they're a multinational corporation with a human resources department, and they make a product. Like, no shit, they're going to do it. Right?
But they didn't start as a multinational corporation. In fact, they started very small.
Well, yeah, but like,
Do you remember the article that was posted to Twitter a while ago?
Oh, yeah, no, the 25-year journey of Magic the Gathering on the New Yorker. Yes, no, that's the only thing I've seen with worse art in it than, like, the actual Magic cards themselves. Like, holy heck. Like, yeah. man, what are you doing? Like, that art in there is just like, wow, that's what you think of me? Like, first of all, I don't look like that. I don't look like some, like, five-year-old cartoon. First of all, anybody could have drawn that stuff. So whoever they're paying to do this, they're getting ripped off.
Yeah, well, I thought it was fascinating, the history that they laid out, because it was obviously,
It's obviously just something that, like, some dudes came up with in a garage, like Dungeons & Dragons. Maybe not the best, maybe not the worst, but they came up with it, and it got popular, and people started playing it. you know?
Well, what's fascinating is the progressive flavor that they put into the article. So it's
Wig history. It's like Wig history applied to Magic the Gathering. If we're going to do that, do the bit, right?
So right, but I don't know if it's revisionist history or not, but they were essentially claiming...
I've got a take on that.
Yeah, well, so if for those who hadn't read the article, they were basically suggesting that the two guys who came up with Magic the Gathering were both, you know, radical progressives in whatever the 70s or 80s, and they started out like that. They said, oh, man, we want diversity, and we want, you know, a large amount of... you know, various people to play our game, because that's what we're going for. So they made Magic the Gathering, which, you know, like it seemed very weird that they would start out from there. And then once the company started taking off with white men, they started to gear it more towards their demographic. Right.
Well, yeah. But they did. But one other thing about the, okay. So they're I think they're being a little bit revisionist, and they're applying a sort of pseudo Whig history to this, wherein they're looking at it through they're projecting like what the modern motivations are onto a bunch of Magic. You cannot tell me reasonably that the guys that invented this were doing anything other than just having fun, and they didn't really care a whole lot about much else. I mean, the earlier sets, like, okay, if you released Arabian Nights today, people would be mad because it's like commoditizing a culture, right? But in the article, they're looking back at sets like Arabian Nights as examples of diversity, right? So they're very clearly like just sort of playing both ends of the spectrum, you know. And to be quite honestly, like, I don't have a problem with, like, the, like, okay, you can say what you want, but the Orientalist aesthetic has been around since like the Victorian era. And like since the importation of like, you know, 1001 Arabian Nights, right? So that's not like, you know, ham-fisted diversity. Like that's like a legit fantasy thing that like people have written about. Like Rudyard Kipling wrote about some stuff like that. Like the Jungle Book was of a similar vein, obviously not the same, but you know, similar. So you know, you don't have to project like a diverse, like you can't, I don't think you can reasonably even project a diversity narrative onto Arabian Nights, because that's not what it was, at least in my opinion, because I don't think they were, you don't start a freaking traditional games company with a political agenda, right?
Well, like, that's what they were trying to claim that they were doing.
Right, they're retconning in like a political, okay, now, I'm not going to sit here and claim that everything's apolitical. And that, you know, but I am going to say that, like, these, you know, you don't make a good game by sitting down and like thinking about my political agenda, you know, that comes later.
I fully believe them when they say that they were, you know, radical leftists in the 80s, because they did come from that kind of area.
Well, yeah,
of the
were they radical leftists? Sure. I mean, like, but what does that mean in the 80s versus today, though? Were these like Bernie Sanders tier, like, dude weed free college people? Like, because they're not, it's worth noting, like, they're applying a modern context to, like, something that happened 40 years ago.
Well, and what I thought was fascinating was that in order to gain market share, they actually geared it more towards white men. In fact, Mark Rosewater even says so as much very early on that, well, you know, our games are mostly geared towards white men, right? Or men, I guess he didn't have the abbreviation of white. But,
well, yeah, I mean, if you look at the Yu-Gi-Oh! Demographics, Yu-Gi-Oh! Is actually a fairly diverse player base, but it's mostly men. But the funny thing is that's like kind of a result of like what Yu-Gi-Oh is. So like I don't like Magic the Gathering is not going to capture that level of diversity because it's not Yu-Gi-Oh.
Yeah, like, no. Yu-Gi-Oh is the softcore smut anime to the, like, you know, to the Magic, like, you know highbrow, like, oh, you know, this card has wonderful,
like,
art.
Yu-Gi-Oh's got some, like, softcore smut. It's got some like dumbass stuff in there, but it's, you know, Yu-Gi-Oh's like popcorn entertainment. And I'm not even saying that's a bad thing. Like, I don't play it, but dude, that's rad. Like, popcorn entertainment is rad. Like,
and the designers of Magic look at Yu-Gi-Oh's like diverse audience, and they're like salivating and rubbing their hands
and they're
vigorously.
Like, but the other thing is they can't bring themselves to print a card like with card art like Dark Magician Girl. Like, they're not going to do that. But that's like why Yu-Gi-Oh's audience is the way it is, though. Like, let's be real here.
So they're in a catch 22. They're cucks, and they really, really want another audience that they don't have. But they also don't want to lose the audience that they have. But they're also ideological in
so
that
they
won't.
Can't do what's necessary
able
to get the audience they don't have.
Right. They're in a catch 22, and this will go on forever and forever and forever. And I almost guarantee you that they will continue to do sets in European style settings,
like,
with John Boyega style characters just jammed in there. It's like, well, you know, we're doing
revealing
this
esoteric knowledge to unsuspecting passerbys,
right?
You know, Eldritch Horrors and stuff.
Yeah.
They're trying to project this sort of design aesthetic without the actual, like, idea. So, like, here's the thing. If people wanted to fix racial politics in North America, you know what we'd do?
Oh man, hit me. I actually
have an honest to God solution. Everyone would sit down in school, and instead of watching like Martin Luther King documentaries, we'd just have everybody sit down and watch Dragon Ball Z together. The cross section of people that think Dragon Ball Z and Naruto are like the raddest shit ever is like actually more diverse than anything that has a diversity quota on it.
Yeah, but we're never going to do that.
I mean, like, if you want to do
that.
Because
the protagonists in Dragon Ball Z literally become super Aryans.
Yeah, but
right?
They're aliens. So, like, that's not important. Like, they're aliens, dude. They have monkey tails. Well,
you've never
they're
heard
aliens
of the bleeding.
They're aliens with monkey tails that throw energy bolts at each other. It's rad, okay?
dude, you've never heard of the Pleiadian theory where the Nordics are actually space aliens?
Well, no, I'm aware. I'm not, the Nordics came, well, okay, first of all, buddy. Space aliens. There were three separate Aryan migrations out of Thule and Hyperborea, you dingus. Real Paranormy hours up in here. That's what I think, is that there were three separate human migrations out of Thule. The Indo-Aryans, that's like a historical retcon, people trying to understand what happened, when in reality there were three separate migrations where you got the first ones, and those would be like the ones you see in the Middle East, and the next one you'd be Mediterraneans, and then your last ones would be your Nords.
I kind of want to make a Thulean campaign setting.
Mine actually borrows heavily from that, because I was reading Rules Against the Modern World at the same time I wrote it. But if anybody wants to hear me like spend an hour explaining the intricacies of my like campaign setting, I can do it. It might make good radio. It might not. Like, but I'd have to know that somebody wanted it. Like, there'd need to be a market need. I don't want to provide something there isn't a market need for. Real libertarian hours up in here. But no, I mean, Yu-Gi-Oh! Has the audience Magic wants, but it also is not what Magic strives to be.
Well, right, and it's, but it has the audience that Magic wants in an ideological sense. Right.
Those are
two different things, where Magic wants to expand its market share, right, and sees this audience that Yu-Gi-Oh has and wants it because it would fulfill
or like
both
an audience like Yu-Gi-Oh's.
Right. But it can't do it because of its, you know, ideological limitations. It can't put big titty magical girls on its cart.
I wasn't going to put it in that way, but
Oh.
Ostensibly, yeah. I mean, they won't do anything like that. And they don't have like the similar, like, I think a large part of the appeal of any game, and a lot of people are probably going to get mad at me for saying this, but you like your game because of the way it looks more so than you like your game because of the way, or like the way that it aesthetically appeals to your notions more so than you like your game because of the rules.
Yeah, I can believe that.
So like, I really like World War II. So I play a World War II game. I'd probably play more World War II games and probably play a ton of different World War II games if I had the chance, because I really, really, really like the way things looked back then. I'm not talking about like just like, oh yeah, no man, y'all like the history, man. No, I just like the way helmets looked, and the fact that people's fashion senses were pretty rad, and like your military uniform had like a little like pressed collar that's folded down like an actual like khaki shirt nowadays, like. I like that. It looks nice to me. So I'm attracted to that. I do not like World War III games. And there's a World War III game that has the same, Team Yankee has basically the same rules as Flames. I'm never going to play it. It just doesn't aesthetically appeal to me.
Yeah, I've always considered it, for me anyway, for as far as aesthetics go, I've always been fascinated by sci-fi that also includes a lot of fantasy tropes or themes. You know, I mean, 40K is an obvious one to name, but also kind of something like Star Wars.
Well, there's also Nier. If you ever want to play a video game, you can go do that bit. You can play Nier Automata. Of course, you have to understand
video games. Really, are we playing video games? I don't know if we want to play video games. That's kind
of. I mean, I play the Warhammer 40K video games, and I play Hearts of Iron 4. So
I know, I'm kidding.
So you know, Hearts of Iron 4 is if you want to play a video game, that's a good one, and especially like one of the worst things that ever happened to role playing. I'm gonna get in my soapbox real fast. One of the worst things that ever happened to role playing games was video games. Because it teaches you really bad habits, especially open world games. Like Grand Theft Auto and Skyrim have done more to ruin role playing game players than any other factor combined.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Not only for the players' sake, but also for the rules' sake. They've one of the biggest issues is trying to port rules from video games into any number of traditional games, right?
Which is dumb. Right. I like, okay, that's the thing, is I always run games. I'm very rules light, less rules focused. I like the problem with players is they get really rules focused, because rules are what gives the players their power, in a sense, is that's how they interact with their world. In theory, they don't understand that you can just interact with the world just role play. Like I could legitimately like work an entire campaign and nobody rolls a single die. That'd be fine, because you could just role play through it and just logic your way through things.
See,
you don't even need rules if you're good enough.
I'd actually disagree with you on that point. So my philosophy has always been that rules give the player an ability to interact with you know, whatever you have set up, you know, if you're the DM or if you're just playing another game. It allows the players to interact through the rules as well as through role play. So for instance, I mean, I'll just use an example that I'm familiar with, like 8th edition 40K, it's really rules light, right? But there's no DM, there's no way for you to actually interact.
That's because it's a war game.
Right.
I mean, exactly. if we're entirely honest, like a war game is going to be a lot different than a role-playing game in the way the rules interact with, like... Because that's what I say to people is, if you want to go fight things... You can play me in Flames. I have an army you can borrow, but I'm here to role play, right?
I just the bottom line is that I like rules where they make sense, you know, and having a lot of rules is fine for me as long as they make sense and they don't clutter too many things up, you know. Like for instance, one nuance that I really like is in 3.5 D&D. The skill system was completely was completely dumb. You did not need the skill system. You know, it was a whole bunch of unused math, and you know, you could just roll a d20 and add whatever to it, right? But as far as the other things in 3.5, I think they did actually serve a purpose, you know, like the feats and the spells and.
I'm saying like, but I under like okay, like here's an example, right, of what I'm trying to get at here. When you give a player a series of rules, they will assume, okay, well, I have a charisma role or an influence role. I can go convince anyone to do anything regardless of any other mitigating factors. And then they get really mad when the local, you know, yahoos don't want to go follow them off on their insane adventure because, you know, they're farmers and they have better things to do, like farm, right?
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about. You have to de-emphasize these mechanical interactions, because the mechanical interactions give players delusions that they have like a sort of, cuz like in a video game, the way things are designed, oftentimes you can just roll high enough on like a hidden piece of RNG to get things to go really weird that they wouldn't work in like a realistic way, right? And you just kind of got to beat that out of players a little bit.
Yeah, and I agree with that, and I just think that complexity where it makes sense is okay, but you do need a good DM in either way.
Right. This is true. You do that. That is a necessary requirement. You need the game master is ultimately like, he is the rule set. He is the arbiter and he's the storyteller. Like that's the focal point of the game.
Yep, I agree.
Yeah. No, I mean, now if we really want to talk about rules, right? You want to do real rules posting hours?
Please.
You want to talk about wargaming. Because it doesn't matter how hardcore your role-playing game is, it still has role-playing, which isn't governed by technical rules. Can't really write rules for it. A war game is only rules. That's it. That's all it is. And a lot of you, maybe you never played a war game IRL before, and you went out and you're looking around at your stuff. Now, I'm not going to tell you what to buy. That's a later episode. We'll cover some specific games and what you should first purchases might be and how you might want to think about buying things. That's not what I want to talk about today. Because today, I want to talk about, you've got some basic stuff. Let's say your buddy gives you a loaner army and he says you can build whatever you want with it. What do you want to be thinking about when you build and play your army? And we're going to be trying to do a little bit more generic, like, what do you want to be thinking about in terms of building your army for just about any war game? Because there is kind of an underlying logic between games that you can use.
Is this where I share my knight list?
My
list of all knights.
You can do that, but I just wanted to go through kind of some of what you want to be thinking about, right? And I think Jack is more of a 40K guy, more of a Flames guy, so we can tie in what we play into this. But you can keep in mind, these are just like examples of how you would apply the thought process I'm going to try to describe here, which I haven't told Jack before, because this is proprietary knowledge. So I'm letting you in on a little secret for free on the internet.
Is this behind the paywall? Is there a paywall?
This isn't Games Workshop, so no.
Oh, all right.
No, this is entirely free. We do it for free because we love you. We love you people. Not in a platonic way, you know? What do you want to be thinking about when you do your list building? So Jack, when you sit down to build a list, what is the first thing you think of?
Honestly, the first thing I think about when I sit down to build a list is what kind of theme do I want to give this list?
I actually think you're wrong.
Ooh.
I think you're wrong. I don't think that's the first thing you think about.
Really? Well, I mean, before the point, whatever point system you use comes in, you know, because you've got an army, and that army does things that the other guy's army probably doesn't do, right?
Yeah.
So you've got a theme to your army.
No. So what you're thinking about is the legal requirements to take an army. What do I have to? What am I required to take? Okay, because that impacts your theme more than anything else. Right, because
yeah,
okay,
I'd agree with that. Yeah.
So let's look at it this way. Let's say I want to build a mechanized army. What am I required to take if there's only one army in the game that can take, say, tank units as compulsory units for the list? And we'll kind of get into that terminology here in a second. Then I'm probably going to want to run that army because that's the tank. But my first thought is, what am I legally allowed to take?
Yeah, and especially for the point value that you're starting at.
Right. So, I mean, and we're just going to assume that you, already have an army. You've already kind of decided on your general theme. Like you've got Imperial Guard or Death Watch or, mid-war German army, right? And by German army, I mean, the German army, not, the Schutzstaffel or the Luftwaffe, that kind of thing. Because the Luftwaffe did field ground forces.
As an aside, I really want a Ratman army. Ratmen are really cool, but go on.
Yeah. Damn shame they don't make those little spinner things with six sides, so you could play you could gamble your rat army while playing it. Those of you in the know will know what we're talking about. Anyway, fidget spinners. You know what I'm saying? Real millennial hours up in here. Fidget spinner Tide Pods. Real boomer hours.
God. Fidget spinners. Anyway, yeah. So, but realize what you said. Maybe you want to make a mechanized army, right?
Right.
That's a theme.
All right.
So what you're really starting out with, what can my army do effectively? And what kind of theme can I start out with my army, right?
Right. Well, the first thing you want to be thinking about when you're thinking about your army, okay, so what is the legal requirement to take your list? Now, we're not talking about oi, mate, do you have your wargaming license? We're not talking about laws, right? There aren't really any laws that apply to wargaming that don't apply to, buying craft stuff. What we're talking about is, okay, so in the game Flames of War, I can take a force, and a force is comprised of formations, and the formations all come out of, a source book, and the formations, the associated formations from that source book have associated force support units, and I'm required to take at least one formation, and then I can take support units with, their hard limit caps. I can only take, two artillery batteries of a certain type, and if I take those, then I am eligible to take an observer, but I can't take an observer without taking artillery. That kind of thing. And then a formation is that's a grenadier company, and the minimum requirements to make a grenadier company are two grenadier infantry platoons and one grenadier headquarters unit, right? So those are the legal limits. If I just want to make a legal list, I have to have those bare minimum things. And 40K is kind of similar. I think they got something similar going on with formation. They have a force organization chart with headquarters and troops, and certain things are required.
In 8th edition, they really opened it up to a lot of different types of formations that you can make. You can pretty much take whatever you want now. It's pretty open.
But you want to have be following certain guidelines, because you get certain benefits in 40K for following guidelines. In Flames of War, you just have to follow the guidelines because it's a historical game.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, once you've got that kind of out of the way, I think the first real thing when you're making your list, when you're thinking about making a list, is, okay, so, for example, I've got my Iron Cross unit cards in front of me, and I own a lot of German infantry, and I loan mid-war German Panzer IVs, short and long, the short-barreled G models, or F1 models, no, not the G models, the F1 models, and the long-barreled F2 models, right? And I like my Panzer IVs. They're not the strongest thing this edition, curse you Battlefront, but I like them. They look nice. So when I'm thinking about that, when I'm looking at what I want to run, I'm either running a Panzer IV company, or I'm running an infantry company with some kind of support units. And
yeah, if I can say something about infantry, I mean, whatever game you're playing, I mean, like I've always considered it really weird when an edition comes out for any kind of game, like, you know, War Machine or 40K or whatever that you play, when an edition comes out where you are able to effectively shoot everything off the table and there is no infantry. I mean, I really consider wargaming to be, should be more or less infantry based with support, you know?
Well, Flames of War does it a little differently because you have your formations, but I'll get to that in a second because you want to think about, okay, what do I want to run? So maybe you wake up one morning, you want to run a Panzer III company or a Sherman company or a Stuart company, right? And you can do that. Again, the way Flames of War is, you can't shoot everything off the table generally. It's very hard to do, even with, like, tank companies. Unless the opponent's only doing, like, the cheese, like, late war. I'm only taking 5 Elephant tanks, and they just get shot off the table because, you know, that's just a dumb list. Because you run in with no infantry support. But it really depends on the game, whether or not you're taking infantry support. How the rules are biased for that. We'll get to that in a moment. We're just wanting to talk on, like, the broad swaths, you know? Because historically, if you're running an attack, you're basically running in with tanks, and you may have some infantry and some trucks maybe later, but mostly you're just spearheading with tanks and armored vehicles.
Yeah, I've definitely run into a lot of lists like that, like mechanized lists. They're pretty interesting. Honestly, like, I don't know about Flames of War. I'm pretty sure they've solve this problem, but mechanized lists tend to be glass cannony, I guess.
Flames actually does solve that problem because infantry are, like, the most durable thing in the game. The actual glass cannon list in Flames is going to be, like, a lot of tanks. Well, it really depends, actually, on a lot of factors. Flames, because of the way Flames works mechanically, it's a lot different from 40K. The units are a lot more similar to one another between nations. And it's actually the skill level of the units that changes them a lot. So there's a lot of overlap between how you'd want to run certain nations. Like, you could maybe make the analogy that, like, the Germans are probably the most comparable to, like, you know, they're probably the most comparable, like, Eldar. The Americans are, like, Space Marines somewhat, but, like, with a little bit lower skill level. The British are, like, the British are like a weird Marine Imperial Guard hybrid, and the Russians are like orcs.
Can you dig in as the British?
You can dig in.
You make
in as
like
anybody.
Trench lines and shit.
You can dig in as anybody. Like, digging in is a core mechanic for infantry in Flames. Like, that's like how the infantry meta runs around. Is like you sit somewhere, you dig in, and then you basically try to spend your time pinning your opponent's artillery battery so it can't kill your infantry. Is how that works.
Interesting.
Yeah, no. So, for example, when I'm looking at a Flames list, the first thing I'm thinking about when I'm building it is I need my core units. So, in Flames, most missions have you defending either one or two objectives, so you want one or two platoons, like at least one decent platoon that can dig in. So if you're building a tank list, you're taking a support infantry platoon, whether you like it or not. Because that infantry... Okay. 40K things are called units. In Flames of War, things are called units too. But in unit in Flames, unless you're playing Soviets, is basically a platoon. So I'm going to just call things platoons, because that's what they are to me. And they'll always be platoons. Excuse me. So you're taking, like, a single platoon of infantry at the very least to dig in and hold that objective. Maybe some anti-tank guns with them. We'll get to that later. And some artillery maybe, because you don't want to not take artillery because that counters infantry. So I'm thinking, okay, I need my legal requirements. I need something to hold objectives. Now I need something. Now I need to think about what I'm going to be fighting, right? And I think this is the most important thing when you're making your list is once you've got your legal requirements and you've got, like, most war games revolve around being able to capture objectives. So in 40K...
I mean, generally speaking, yeah.
Yeah, there are very few missions in wargames that are just, like, kill everyone on the opposition team or, like, break the enemy's force morale. Like, there's one mission like that in Flames and nobody plays it because it drags on really long. So, like, with 40K, you get guys that have, like, I think it's called objective secured, and they can just automatically hold an objective. And you meet that requirement by using the formations.
Let me talk about that a little bit.
Okay,
because
I don't know what I'm talking about here.
Well, I mean, so in 40K, 40K has had a kind of a weird relationship with its foot sloggers, its troops, because not all of 40K's infantry is made the same. Obviously, there are different toughness values, and they're wildly different factions with different flavors.
This isn't World War II, so like the difference between like a Turkish infantryman like drafted into the German army like against his will, and like a Russian infantryman drafted into the Russian army and against his will is very minimal, apart from like slight doctrinal differences in equipment, right? The difference between a space elf drafted into his local space elf army against his will, and the difference between a bog standard human drafted into his local human army, or Grot, you know, goblin drafted into his army, is very wide. So 40K accounts for this.
Right. And I feel as though GW instituted this so that they could give an overall buff to all troops, you know, that that would normally otherwise maybe not be be as effective. Because why would you take
pretty bad, and most aren't. Some of your troops are not as good as your support options.
Yeah, I mean it definitely varies. Like the vanilla Space Marine is probably one of the worst troops.
That's because everything in 40K is balanced around killing Space Marines, though. Like everything's
not only that though, but I don't know. Maybe we can get into more of like the points per wound. But it's got one of the worst points per wound, and despite its good save, they really, and you're right. Like everything is kind of revolves around killing them, and their equipment is not that great, honestly. So what GW did was they gave all troops the ability to objective secured, which means that if you're on an objective and somebody else has
this
something
is only
that
if
is
you
not
follow a the force organization chart, though.
If you're Battle Forged in 8th edition, but if the other side has a tank on the objective and you go up and you get within range of the objective with your troops will capture the objective and not the tank. So this is a game, right, which makes sense, which is why you'd want boots on the ground rather than just an all-tank army, right?
You guys are probably looking at me like, dude, you're dumb. How in the hell does that make any sense? Now, the reason that makes sense is IRL, like, you capture objectives by like forcing your opponent off of them. So as long as there's just some infantry dude in a hole next to a like the hill he needs, he's going to impede your ability to move around there because he can take pot shots at your infantry. And infantry are what hold objectives IRL. Tanks just kind of break through infantry formations to clear the way for like enclosing or rapturing or like surrounding infantry formations, cutting them off and forcing them to surrender. Like that's how you win battles IRL. So that makes sense. Like 40K is not the most realistic game, but it's realistic kind of in that sense.
Well, and they also, in a frequently asked questions, they also nerfed flyers too. Like flyers cannot hold objectives, and if you shoot their entire army off the board except for flyers, they
don't come on.
Well, I mean they automatically lose because they don't have anyone on the field
to take objectives with.
Well, not only that, but they don't count flyers as, I don't know, I guess part of your, if you're counting units that are still on the field, flyers don't count. So they're strictly support rather than just, you know, rather than just tanks that move better basically.
Yeah.
So the first thing
you want is things to hold objectives with. That's your first priority. The next thing you need to be immediately thinking about is, okay, I've got something I can hold an objective with. What is my opponent taking to come and take my objective with, and how do I kill it?
So list tailoring.
Well, not list tailoring, because, okay, think about it this way. So in a 40K list, what is the broad swath of things you're going to see? You're going to see high toughness, tank, and monstrous creature units. You're going to see a lot of little tiny dudes like guard equivalent or Tyranid equivalent units. And then you're going to see space marines, a lot of space marines, right? So you want to have things in your army, weapons that are capable of dealing with these problems as they arise, right? You don't want your entire army, like, everyone is equipped with a las cannon except for the mooks, who are equipped with, like, you know, bolt guns. But, you know, bolt guns aren't the most effective anti-infantry weapon in the game because there's, like, artillery that does that and stuff, right? So you've got all this stuff. How do you deal with Tyranid spam with that army? You don't. How do you deal with this army, that army? You don't have Ignore's cover, right? You want to be thinking about what is going to... And this will depend somewhat on your local meta, right? So
local meta. I was meaning to bring up that word.
Yeah, yeah. Which is the meta game. Like, what are people taking in your local area versus other local areas? So, like, my Flames of War meta is dominated by British tank spam lists, which is, like, a very early 4th edition tactic, and it continues to be a thing. But we're anticipating, with the new release of the Russians, we're going to see a lot more, like, KV tanks, because they're heavier, and they're pretty cheap, because they've got horrible crews in them. So you want to be thinking, like, okay, I need good anti-tank, I mean, good anti-tank, like, PAC 40s, FLAC 88s, you know, Martyrs, those kinds of things. You know, units that can kill big, nasty tanks at a long range. I need a way to deal with heavy tanks, and I need a way to, like, outmaneuver and deal with, like, little tanks that'll be everywhere too, right? So that's what I'm thinking about when I'm building my list. Like, 40K, you want to be thinking, like, okay, if my opponent brings a flyer, what do I have in my army that can deal with it? If my opponent brings Space Marine equivalent units, like 3-up infantry save, toughness 4, I think it's a 4-up infantry save now, something like that, I don't know.
No, it's still 3, but yeah, my particular local meta is actually Tyranid heavy.
Right, so if you've got a Tyranid heavy local meta, you maybe want to be like, I'm not going to bring las cannons. Maybe I want to think about heavy bolters.
Actually,
Las cannons work for those. Yeah, well,
in fact, they work way better because their monstrous creatures usually ignore the character roll, so you can shoot them with impunity. But yeah, it's mostly high strength, high armor penetration, and then a lot of, and then you attempt to manage the horde, right? That's kind of the strategy with Tyranids, is to take out their synapse, large creatures that, you know, give you problems, like the tyrants, and then just try to manage their horde and whittle it down until you can win.
Right, like in Flames of War, one of the easiest ways to win the game is, okay, you can break your opponent's army by killing his formation down to the point where there's only one unit left in his formation, right? I used to play against a Russian player who used to bring, like, 21 T-34 formations, like, it's like 21 T-34s in a formation, right? And only one formation, the rest of it was support. So I'd kill 11 T-34s and win the game. Because you kill his headquarters T-34, and then one platoon of 10 T-34s, the other platoon of 10 T-34s, and the rest of his army will run off. So that's how I dealt with that. And so what I ended up doing is I'd end up taking a, like, King Tiger as a distraction, because it can't be penetrated from the front by the stuff he was running, and then and he'd get distracted by it, and then I'd use my PAC 40s and Panzer 4s to whittle down his T-34s while my infantry held on for dear life.
Yeah, I've had a few games like that. I do have one Imperial Guard player that has a tank list where he basically brings a parking lot, and if you don't know the rules for Lehman Russ tanks in 40K, it's pretty, when you're facing down 8 of them, it's pretty much you're either going to win or you're going to lose badly.
Basically.
because their main gun can fire twice if they don't move. So
if
it's
they move
literally
underneath a certain amount of distance as well.
Yeah.
So right. they can move and shoot those two shots. Two shots is always better than one. That's the other first rule of wargaming: shot volume is always better over shot quality. because you do not want to risk. You want seven chances to kill something as opposed to just one.
And generally speaking, shooting is better than melee.
In most games, yes. Especially in Flames. Flames does not... Melee is always the last option. Flames, yeah. Bolt action are very similar in that sense. 40k, less so, but still.
Less so, but I would still recommend that you bring a lot of shooty with you.
Unless you're just, like, your entire goal is to just shred your opponent in melee. Like, you can do it with orcs. Orcs, I think, have always been viable for, like, just melee hordes.
Yeah, Blood Angel too, but why exactly would you say that shooting is better than melee? I'm mostly asking as a question.
For Flames?
Yeah.
Okay, so in Flames, unless you've got
for anything really.
For most games, unless the game is designed around melee, I think War Machine might be a little more like that. The way it ends up working out is you've got these melee units, and the way most games work for melee is you attack your opponent, and then your opponent gets to attack you in the same turn. Or in Flames, the melee just keeps going until it's resolved. So what this means is you're attacking your opponent, but you give them free attacks at you or a free chance to hit you at the same time. Whereas with shooting, you just get to shoot your opponent. They don't get to shoot back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, one of the ways that I explained it to my friend was that in order, you know, to shoot and kill somebody, you have to aim and fire, and you don't really get any kind of any return fire until their turn, right? Whereas with melee, you have to get into position. You know, you have to have a successful charge, which I don't know other games.
Some games have static charge rules. 40k, you roll randomly for the distance you charge. So sometimes you can't even make it into the distance to actually close with the enemy.
Right. And then you have to hit them, right? So now this is the point where we're at in shooting phase, right? So we finally got into shooting phase, and then you have to wound them, right? And then you have to penetrate their armor or whatever.
Attack you, which isn't in the shooting phase.
Right, exactly. So then they get to reciprocate their thing. So basically, you know, unless your army is kitted out for that kind of thing, you know, it's usually a better idea to shoot something rather than charge in there blindly and hope for the best.
One other really important thing to keep in mind about this is with a lot of armies, or with a lot of games, the way you win a war game is you don't actually kill your opponent. The way you win a war game is forcing your opponent to make poor decisions and maximizing the amount of damage you can do to your opponent while minimizing the amount of damage you take. Shooting maximizes the damage you do to your opponent while minimizing the damage you take by you. It's a chance you can do damage to your opponent with your opponent not doing damage to you. With fighting, clan to hand, it's a chance you do damage to your opponent and a chance your opponent does damage to you.
And this also gets into a broader topic about, I guess kind of like chess strategy almost, where if, you know, you're going to be exchanging units all game, kind of like pieces on a chessboard.
I actually had a really good game against a like highly ranked Flames of War player one time where I lost nothing, but that was entirely luck of the rolls. But yes, generally speaking, this is true.
So you have a 100 point costed unit or, you know, model or whatever against a 200 point costed unit or model, and if you can kill it, then, you know, that unit has just paid for itself.
It has paid for itself. Also, you can also think of it like this. If you have a 100-point unit or model, and you are delaying a 200-point unit or model or forcing it to do a bunch of dumb stuff and it can't do what it's there to do, right?
Then
it's also earning back its points because, hey, it might even die, and that 200-point model may live the entire game, but if it's, say, like Space Marine Devastators, long-range Space Marines with, like, big las cannons, plasma cannons, heavy bolters, you know, those kind of weapons. Let's say you have some kind of deep-striking, like, back-row harasser unit that sort of like harasses them the entire game, like only costs like half as much as they do, you know, keeps trying to charge them, keeps taking pot shots at them, and they've got to deal with this unit for like a couple turns. That's a couple turns. They're not focusing that on your like big Tyranid dudes or your tanks or like your high value Terminator armor assets. Basically what I'm describing is a bunch of expensive like stuff, right?
Right, right. So you've sacrificed a pawn in order to make sure that the bishop is not as effective.
Right. For another example in this, in Flames of War, is if you have first turn and you can get your mortars ranged in on the opponent's howitzer battery and you can pin it and then they can't they fail their unpin roll, they can't fire bombardments with that, which just means that like a 3-point unit of mortars just basically rendered useless a 11-point unit of howitzers for a turn, which is
right.
Very, very, very valuable. And that's part of the reason you take mortars.
Right. And
if you can manage it.
And with another thing is that with most war games, as we've already discussed, it's usually about victory points or some sort of objective. So if you move your very high-valued unit and sacrifice them in somewhere, but it gets you a lot of victory points. Like, victory points are your end goal, right? It's not...
Or the objective, not, right? Like,
right,
it's
the objective.
Yeah, sacrifice a King Tiger for an objective if I know I can make that trade.
Right,
and the
exactly.
King Tiger is a fifth of my army cost. And it's a really good model, too. Although the King Tiger is a very whorish tank.
Right, there are a lot of situations where I've actually sacrificed very high-costed units in order to get victory points, and eventually it came out that I won because of that, despite the fact that, you know, I just rushed them into a wood chipper, you know?
Ostensibly, yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the sort of knowledge of what makes a good trade-off kind of comes later. And the other thing is forcing your opponent to move. Most war games feature a penalty for movement, whether that's a penalty to firing for a lot of weapons. Flames of War, you take a half rate of fire on just about everything other than a vehicle-mounted machine gun. So if you can put your assets in a way that'll force your opponent to move his assets, that's going to penalize their fire, put you in an advantage. You want to be the one forcing your opponent to move. In anything that can force your opponent to move a unit is useful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd agree with that. I'd also like to say that you go. I need to gather my thoughts here a little bit.
The other thing, okay, so like in Flames of War, you got like your FLAC 88 guns. You know, everybody likes FLAC 88s. They're very low rate of fire and they're very high anti-tank, which contradicts what I said earlier about high rate of fire, generally speaking. But the reason you take an 88 is it's got a really long range. It can't move, but you just stick it somewhere where it can see a large swath of the board. And it can maybe kill maybe one enemy tank it sees a turn, generally speaking, if it's on the move towards it or something else. But what it also does is it prevents your opponent from kind of peeking that sight line with his tanks. Like, most opponents will be like, yeah, the 88 isn't great because, you know, it's only got two shots a turn, and it can only theoretically kill, like, out of those two shots, maybe, like, 0.5 of them will be effective, right? So it'll maybe kill, it has a quarter of a chance of killing something a turn. So it's not the best thing in the game for sheer killing power, right? Pack 40s do much better than that, but it's got a long range, it's imposing, it's got a little psychological factor to it, and it'll prevent your opponent from taking his tank platoons into a large area of the board. It's an area denial weapon for its points cost, and that's what you take it for. You don't take it because, I'm going to kill a whatever from a long range. You take it because you can just deny large sections of the board to your opponent's movement.
And that's kind of... I remember what I was going to talk about now. Basically, sometimes the best thing, you know, when you've got in the very early game when everything is, you know, undamaged and, you know, you're looking for a fight, it's very, very tempting to start running your guys up the field or doing something with them, right? Sometimes the best thing to do is to just, like, hide this unit over here or not move this unit and
just take pot shots.
Right, wait. Sometimes the best course of action is to do no action.
And just to even build on that, generally speaking, in most games, the actual casualties taken would follow like an exponential curve. right? Where we're like very early on, the first two turns, not a whole lot dies. And then the last like four, basically like half of everything is basically wiped off the board in like two turns. And then like, you're basically left with like whatever you have after that to kind of like squabble over objectives with. Because the army's kind of like, the game develops, the board state develops, and the reserves start coming on, and you start meeting each other at weird angles, and things start happening. You know, in Flames of War, you start getting side armor shots, things start evaporating, and units start getting destroyed. If things will start to develop more. But in those early turns, you expect, like, oh, I'm just, like, turn one, just going to wipe this dude off the board. It's very difficult to win a war game turn one. You can't do it. You can't just like wipe your opponent first turn. You got to wait a while.
Yeah, sometimes that clutch unit of scouts that you've had, you know, behind the building all game not doing anything will come in handy. You know, sometimes you get an objective that says, "Oh, you know, you have to take this objective over here." Well, you've still got that unit of scouts, whereas if they poked their head up and tried to, you know,
assassinate
tried to shoot
somebody.
At somebody.
Yeah.
Right. They could have gotten shot off the board. So, you know, or maybe keep that deep strike, unit in reserves for like one more turn. If you don't have anything for them to do, just keep it in reserve and make them come on turn three or turn four.
And the other thing, with Flames of War, when you're playing like infantry heavy lists, like I like to, you spend a lot of time just like, the vast majority of what you do with your list is you build your list, then you set your list down and like lay down on your fields of fire. There's very little movement because you don't want to be moving your infantry around a ton. Like, there are obviously cases when your opponent has like batteries sighted on them, you got to move them around and stuff. But you basically just want to sit yourself down and just camp. So you're not going to want to do heroic like human wave charges to go like drive somebody off a bridge or something. You're going to want to like force your opponent to come to you on your circumstances. That's the other thing that's important to do. You win the game not by killing things. I cannot emphasize this enough. You win the game by putting your opponent in situations where they have to choose between bad choice and a worse choice. And when you can start dictating your opponent's decisions, dictating their movement to them, you can start controlling what they do through inputs, through movement, through having the right threats in the right areas. That's how you win, and that's in the abstract. You want now the actual like what, and for any game you play, it's going to boil down to that for like how you would win. Like if you want to go read up on 40K strategy, you're going to end up with what, if you just boiled it down to a very abstract level, is exactly what I'm saying to you right now.
Yeah, and to circle back around a little bit, when you're going and building out your army, you know, try to think about that a little bit. You know, try to think about, well, what kind of units can I take to deny my opponent, you know, an area for their troops, let's say. Like, you know, if you're playing something where troops have an advantage of some kind, right? Find something that allows you to deny, to have area of denial, right? And then try to see how you can support that and then kind of build out from there.
Or even look at it like, okay, if they're going to try to move up into here, I'm going to have things there. So, you know, or think about it this way. What kind of units can I have that prevent my opponent from moving infantry in the open? What kind of units can I take that prevent my opponent from moving his tanks around? How can I block, like, is there a unit I can take that can just block off a large section of the board for movement for somebody? You know? Well, is there? If there is, you might want to think about how can I incorporate that unit? How can I use it? What does it do? What, you know, think about those kinds of things.
And for all you 40K fans out there that remember older editions, this is even more useful in this edition as well. Is the old Rhino metal box strategy, because Rhinos are pretty big, but relatively to other tanks, they're pretty cheap. So when you run up with your Rhinos and your Rhinos have done whatever, you know, you took them to do, you can plant them right in between two buildings and deny your opponent the ability to move, you know, down certain corridors.
Right. I mean, like, one of the biggest things you learn when you play mechanized units in Flames, where you have, like, a bunch of half-tracks with some infantry, is you learn, well, if I'm playing defensively, I'll just set up the half-tracks, like, drive them out as a wall in between me and the opponent as an assault screen. Then as they shoot the half-tracks then become, like, difficult terrain that provides me bulletproof cover. Great.
Yeah, or the ability to hide units, right? But
right.
Behind them.
And so like, you got to learn how to, like, you know, you don't want anything to die ideally, but that's not the way the game works. It's about
well,
trading.
Yeah.
This is a game. These games, you're trying to think again. You're trying to leverage things to your advantage and a control movement. That Rhino strategy that controls your opponent's movement. You can start funneling them in ways that you want them funneled.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, always make your really cheap personnel carriers make your personnel carriers to be the most annoying units to your opponent, right? Because your opponent's going to look at your personnel carriers and it's like, well, they already, you know, deposit all their troops. They're not that big of a threat. No, they are a threat.
And Flames of War, basically every, like, half track in the game is a mobile pillbox. So everybody views them as, like, about the most, well, it's a mobile machine gun nest, ostensibly, with just fewer shots. Everyone views them as about the most annoying thing on the board. So in Flames, unless you're playing a rookie opponent, you're going to have very little trouble actually convincing your opponent that this is true. So they may actually, like, the worst thing to happen with your mechanized units in Flames and 40K is if they get hit and the transport dies while the dudes are in it, and that's always a problem. So you want to avoid
yeah,
that too. Like, that's even more so important than the rest of what we just told you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Make sure they're alive so that they can actually do something.
Right. Yeah. Don't get killed. It's dumb advice, but it works.
Yeah. Yeah, our advice should not be construed as, you know, if we die, we win.
Right. No, it's not.
if you achieve your objective, you win.
Right. Right. Your objective. That's the game. The game has an objective. It's like, it's not hard. There's an objective. You complete the objective, you win. Boom. Yeah. How do I get from, you know, how do I win the objective? And don't, you know, it's not even like with as few casualties as possible. It's just win the objective.
Right. Well, and even if you do achieve all of your objectives, sometimes you do still lose, but those are usually the best games that you ever play. Like some of the best games that I've ever played, we both had like 14 victory points apiece and they just edged out one more victory point. Right. Well, I accomplished all my objectives and all my dudes died, but I still had a great time.
The closer games are always more fun.
Oh yeah. Yeah, absolutely. It's partially why you do this, right?
Right. If you can find an opponent games. Who can consistently give you close games, you've found a good opponent.
Mm-hmm.
The only two kinds of opponents you want to play. You want to play someone who's either going to curb stomp you, or you want to play someone who's going to give you a close game. Because those are the two kinds of games you're actually going to learn from. You're not going to learn anything when you just sit there and you just beat up on somebody.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Like, there are a lot of really good people in my meta, and I always try to seek them out and just get curb stomped over and over and over again. I just learn over, like, you know, how do you move this? How do you move that? Where do you put that? You know, I learned a lot of tricks about half tracks just watching dudes, like, beat me up with half tracks. I'm pretty decent with German half tracks now.
Yeah, and I would also suggest to seek out, especially older squad-based, not squad, but plate-based war games, like the old the old metal plates that had rows and rows and rows of guys on it, because the older war games and the older war gamers usually have these lessons down pat, because movement is harder, like a lot of things are harder to do in those kinds of games.
If you want to if you want to get really good at war games, just in the abstract, go play Napoleonic Wars with a bunch of 40-year-old dudes, like or a bunch of, like, sometimes even in their 60s. Go play Napoleonic War with, like, some old like dudes who've been around since, like, before Dungeons and Dragons was invented. Like,
what 6-inch move? What are you doing? Why? What are you?
It's a flat 6 inches. What are you talking about?
Right. 12 inches. I'm not, I can't move that far. You know?
Yeah, yeah, no, so. You see some pretty like you'll learn something.
Yeah.
And those are generally like, you're going to like historicals tend to be a lot more difficult than a lot of other games. And they will teach you very quickly. A lot of, I'd say I've played Flames about the same amount of time I've played 40K, and Flames has taught me a ton more than 40K yeah. in terms of like how you want to play a game and how you want to like prosecute a battle just through how ruthlessly tough a historical war game can be and how restrictive it can be on you on what you're able to do.
Yeah, I played a it was a little bit more modern than Napoleonic Wars. It was something like it was something like a Civil War game, but I played that, and you know, there were so many different rules to, you know, that you had to, and this kind of goes back to my thing about rules, where, you know, there were so many restrictions in how far you could move and how far you could shoot and, you know, how you wound and everything, that I went back to 40K and I was like, this is a baby's game. What the hell am I doing playing this game?
Flames is actually simpler in a lot of ways than 40K.
Yeah.
The depth comes out in a few ways that it's a bit different. 40K is more complicated because everything has more stats than it does in Flames. But Flames has a lot of weird little options and things that you can do with movement, like and the way the game is sort of balanced around its terrain and whatnot. Flames is a very terrain-dependent game as well, which I guess we really haven't touched on, but it's because it's very variable. And how you interact with terrain is actually really a lot more dependent on the rules set of your game. Like in Flames, terrain doesn't really impede infantry, but it does a hell of a lot for guns and tanks on their movement. So you want to be thinking about that. But in 40K, terrain functions differently than it does in Flames and whatever. It's
in 40K, terrain is basically a jungle gym.
Yeah.
You know, you just you can move up, you can move down.
Like in Flames, you can't see through forests. Like, period. Like, you just can't see through them unless you're, like, within a certain amount of distance of something in the forest. You can't shoot at it. You can't even know it's there.
Yeah, which I appreciate rules for terrain, but, I mean, it's like, I'm very variable when it comes to terrain because, I mean, on one hand, it's cool, you know, and it lends a bit of realism to it and all this other stuff.
You want to play on a neon, like not neon, but like a very bright green, just sort of flat open space with a couple rocks on it.
Of course not. You don't want to do that. But on the other hand, the way people put terrain down on a board, it's usually not equal, you know, it tends to lean towards one player or the other, and you know, it can get a little.
I have a story time about that sometime.
Ooh,
worst
yeah.
match of 40K I ever had. yeah. Guy insisted on setting up all the terrain in three lines, and it was all supposed to be symmetrical.
So he had terrain autism.
That's no, what you're telling me? He was cheesing actually.
Oh. Yeah. I had an issue with that. Some guy set up terrain so that I couldn't get to his artillery piece that didn't need to see my dudes. So it's like I kept getting bombarded by something that I couldn't see. It was really annoying.
Yeah, Flames. Basically the general rule is it's got to kind of look organic and natural for terrain setup. So that kind of mitigates things. It's like a lot less terrain cheese.
Yeah, I mean, I've seen a lot of people get super butt mad at game stores when the terrain setup doesn't go their way, and they're just like, "Oh, well, you know, I just lost immediately." It's like, well, I don't know. I mean, I tend to roll with the punches when it comes to that kind of thing.
Well, the best way to do it is just kind of like. Well, Flames of War, it's a lot less objectionable because, like, every Flames of War board, whether you like it or not, is very similar. It's just that they all kind of follow the same cues, because they all kind of follow like sort of these unwritten rules of how buildings interact with roads and ponds and fields and things in real life human settlements.
So my conclusion is, fuck terrain. Just put a little tree in the middle of your bright green table, and that's your only bit of terrain. If you can get to that,
Terminator's player.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
My conclusion is, if it doesn't look like something you drive past on the highway or something you'd see, you shouldn't be playing with it.
So no, follow the rainbow Eldar ruins terrain.
I'm talking like in like the Eldar ruins can be laid out, but they'd have to be laid out in the way someone would logically lay out a city, right? Like, you know. I see a lot of dumb 40K boards, is what I'm saying. Like, really dumb.
Yeah. I might have to go into that at a later date.
If you like,
all the dumb 40K players that I've met in my time.
Look at some of the terrain setups in the rulebooks for 40K, and it's just like, what the heck are you doing? Like, in the Flameswar rulebook, they have, like, these terrain setups at the beginning, and they're explaining, like, oh, yes, in Eastern Europe, there's this gully, and here's how it would interact with a river, and that's kind of how you would want to set that up for, like, optimal playing position. Like, with 40K, it's just like, dude, there's, like, some ruins in the corners, yeah, and then, like, there's a hill, and then there's, like, some there's, like, a couple blown-up forests randomly.
If you get within 1 inch of this copyrighted piece of terrain that we can sell you for $150, you'll get a bonus. Yeah.
Battlefront sells its own terrain, but it's all really high quality. It's nice stuff.
Well, I mean, I think GW also has some pretty good terrain pieces, but yeah, I agree. The terrain pieces that GW sells are pretty basic, and they don't really offer a lot of variability. You know,
Flames,
I mean,
of War just introduced the customizable four-layer ruin, the classic. But it's yeah. Stalingrad, so we're doing the city fighting meme. So this is not like a 40K tier kind of thing. This is like most Stalingrad.
I do actually have, I think, 9 or 12 tiles of Zone Mortalis that are no longer available, which is the
dang,
like, bulkhead.
It's pretty, yeah, pretty rare,
and it's all painted, and it's painted pretty well too.
That's pretty rare. Yeah, I have a bunch of stuff I made myself, and honestly, that's how you do it.
Yeah,
put some textbooks under a piece of cloth. You got a hill. Go to the craft store, buy some foam, hot glue it together. You got a building. Bam, done. Easy peasy.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. Some of the best terrain is terrain that you build yourself.
Basically.
Yeah. So did you have anything else?
Generally speaking, no. Basically, like, if you want to kill a KV-1, you got to take a pack 40. That's a new rule.
What about a Nebelwerfer?
Nebelwerfers are not good at killing tanks. It's an explosive dispersion device.
What if I want to werf my Nebels?
Well, you use those to counter Soviet infantry hordes. You pin them down while they move.
Okay.
The point of the Nebelwerfer is that it has a huge bombardment radius. Like, its bombardment template is 10 inches by 10 inches in a square, because everything in Flames of War is a square, as opposed to the 6-inch by 6-inch normal one, which is about the size of the standard Soviet horde when it's spread out. Like, it's about half that size, about twice that size of the template. So you use that to just, like, if your opponent's moving his Soviet infantry somewhere you don't like, you just hit him, pin him, nope.
I'm so glad I asked that.
Why?
I don't know. I just that was one of the funniest pieces when I was flipping through the book. Saw Nebelwerfer.
Oh yeah, the Nebelwerfer, the rocket launcher. Man, like, basically, like, they need like a they need like a the Chad Wargamer versus the Virgin role player meme, and like the Chad Wargamer knows multiple foreign languages. Only words he knows in them are weaponry words. Like, right. Like I say rifle in like 7 languages, tank in like 8. He's like, oh, Panzer, Pinsirni, Tankovi, Tank, Sencho, you know? Those are some fun words.
You got the virgin role player. He plays adult, pretend time.
Well, adult pretend time. The Chad Wargamer carries on proud Prussian martial tradition that's been practiced since the late 1800s. The virgin role player buys pre-painted miniatures from companies that hate him and that employ pedophiles. The Chad Wargamer buys complex and intricate multi-part plastic kits from companies that enjoy his business and cater specifically to his wants and needs, paints them himself. The virgin role player has a card on the table to tap if someone's feeling offended. The Chad Wargamer literally paints swastikas on tanks because of historical realism. tells anyone who tells him he can't to sod off, and it's his frickin' tank.
And they're Finnish. Blue and yellow swastikas.
No. The way you do that, if you really want to coat everything in swastikas, is they would used to
in
put
yellow
their...
swastikas. I want yellow swastikas, damn.
That's
it.
The Finnish Air Force. The blue ones are the ground forces. If you want to quote it, coat everything in swastikas. Back in the 40s, when the Germans had a functional air force in like 43, they'd like put their flag on the top of the turrets of their or on the engine deck of their tanks. As like an air marker, so that like, you know, you couldn't see it from the ground, but like if you're flying above, you know whose tank is whose, right? So what you do is you take like printer paper, you print off a bunch of like German flags, you soak them in PVA glue and glue them to the tops of the tanks. And you kind of like rumple them up and put them on there, and you can actually do that, and people will like, and you could in theory do it to every tank in your army, but like normally it was like 1 in 3 or 4 that had it, but It actually looks really nice, like, because the Russians did it too, so you can do it with Russian tanks too. The Americans and British didn't do it as much because they like painted big white stars on their vehicles instead. That was like their air marking. So that's your little fun fact on like the Chad Wargamer versus the Virgin everyone else.
That's a good way to.
That's like my hobby tip of the week. I still haven't done it for my Panzer IVs, but I will do it. Mark my words. I'll post pictures when I do.
Post pictures. Yeah, I gotta start posting pictures of my army too.
Yeah, no.
Maybe I'll get to that once.
I still have all my army pictures stickied because I'm a vain person.
Vain and narcissistic.
Yeah.
That's the Chad Wargamer.
The Chad Wargamer has opportunity to play the same military units that his grandparents served in a war that actually happened.
There you go.
The virgin role player plays an elf in a setting that will never exist. The Chad Wargamer recognizes many cultures because he owns little armies that represent those cultures' martial traditions. The virgin role player respects weird and obscure cultures that he finds interesting and/or titillating. His understanding of a culture only goes into his country's media's understanding of that culture and surface level.
Surface level. That's a good.
Yeah, it's a very surface level, facile understanding of foreign cultures and role playing games. I've always found, like,
yeah,
miniature wargaming. They don't care about understanding the culture. What needs to be understood is how their tanks and tactics functioned, which arguably gives you a better understanding of that culture than just the facile understanding of the aesthetics.
Yeah, maybe in a later episode we should go into the martial tradition and how that is both informed and informs culture, you know?
I'm not a historian. I'm not like qualified to talk about that, but sure.
Well, I mean, I'm not a historian either, but I think I can bring something together. Maybe get a little bit of help. It could be interesting. But yeah, you want to?
Yeah. That's that. My advice is if you're gonna pick a tank as a waifu, do not want to choose the tiger. She's a whore. No, she doesn't wear long armor skirts. She has her treads hanging out everywhere. Just don't. The other piece of advice I have for you is the tiger is always going to be trash in Flames of War, because I don't know why, even though Battlefront uses it on like half their logos, it's always going to be overpriced, generally speaking. You're better off running her sluttier older sister, the King Tiger, or simply just running Stugs or Panzer Force. Unless it's mid-war, in which case the Stugs so far have been pretty lackluster. So, Kursk is not going to be rad. Panthers are also going to be overpriced. Bolt action rifles are always going to be good. Your thoughts?
My tank waifu is a Fellblade.
Fellblade's not real, man.
Yeah, whatever.
You're only allowed to choose tanks that actually existed. Like, that's the rule.
Well then, I'm gonna have to research this. I can't just make up my mind.
No, there's a game on Steam called Panzer Medals. It'll help you choose.
Mm.
That's like one of the five video games I've ever actually like played and cared about.
Yeah, because fuck Sonic.
Well, I like Metal Gear. Metal Gear's pretty good.
Yeah, I guess it's okay. It's
yeah.
Okay.
Anyway, that's that. Go make the all-plasma guard kill team that we described in episode 1. Go bully your local soy boys. Have fun.
Peace.
Peace out. See you guys. All right. Bye.
Yeah.